Jamie.
I'm Wendell.
And I'm Patrick.
And
this is
Yes
But Why
Podcast.
Thank you, Shannon, so much for coming and sitting down with us and chatting about creative stuff.
Absolutely. Sure.
Cool. I appreciate you coming over at podcasting from my home and having dinner with us.
It's yeah,
really great
it was delicious.
Great. Oh, good. I'm so glad.
Very nice.
Sharing the food. Yeah, I'm doing it. So I thank you so much. We had a lot of scheduling back and forth about this, and I'm happy about it. You know, you were so sweet. You're like, oh, thank goodness we get this done.
Yeah.
But it's like, hey, I'm so excited that you're working all the time and that you're doing stuff.
Yeah,
and that
you're
busy.
Thank you. It's mostly, most of the conflicts were auditions that didn't go anywhere, but.
Doesn't matter, gotta do it though.
Yeah. Right, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so you are, is actor the sort of word that you use to describe what you do? You performer? What do you think?
I don't even know how to think about it right now. I think actor is what I probably, it's the easiest thing to convey to people what I do, because I do a little bit of different things in the acting sphere. That kind of contains most of it.
Right.
I also write, and I'm like, the older I get, the less likely I'm going to have some sort of breakout role that's going to, you know, put me on the path to financial security as an actor.
Sure.
So I've been doing a lot more writing, but that hasn't really, you know, that hasn't taken off 100% really. So so actor is probably what I use to describe myself most often creatively. Depending on the context, might be, oh, I'm a voice actor, or I do improv. But yeah, actor kind of contains all of that.
I feel like a lot of people have like very specific, like, this is the word that describes me. Some people get mad at comedian or like performer. I'm like, I'll literally take any word that isn't like, you know, works at an office.
Right, right. Performer is fine. Comedian, I feel like for one thing, I think like when people say comedian, they automatically think stand up. So I shy away from that just because I've never done stand up. Even though a lot of what I end up doing is in the service of comedy, and I'm a comedic actor, but I don't usually say comedian or comic, because I think a lot of people just, even if they hear improv, they leap to stand up a lot of the time.
Yeah.
But if someone called me a comedian or a comic, I wouldn't get angry.
Oh, right on.
That seems a lame thing to no offense to all the people who are very particular about how they're described.
Yeah, well, I mean, I right now I think there's a lot of there's a lot of stuff going on in the world about like image and who they are, who we are, and
gotta protect your brand, man.
Ourselves.
Yeah, right.
You know, things like
ice cream man's coming by.
We love it. Legit, that's the third ice cream man today. One was like 5 minutes right after the previous one, and I wanted to be like, guys. Neither of you.
You know they're like cousins and they've got some beef and they're like trying to poach each other's territory or something.
NPR one time had an extraordinary like documentary about that. It was
about like beefing ice cream men.
Yes, he started his own.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, they would block the cars in and stuff so they could. Yeah, it was great. It was real good.
Ice cream truck turf war.
Yeah. Cut through.
Man, so I guess that means that you really just can freak out about anything.
Yeah.
Between the name people call you and whether or not somebody else can sell ice cream.
Ice cream in your turf. Right. Yeah.
I'm assuming they have real thin margins and that's why it's a big deal.
Right.
Like 5% margins, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, plus, I mean, just the cooling in your car alone. Like, in this town, get out of here.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. It's like all the food trucks. I'm always like, you guys really love it hot, huh? It's the thing you're digging it.
It's the thing you're digging it, right.
You're like super psyched about it. You're like, if it could be 150, I'd be happier. Okay. Sure.
Yeah, if I could stand in 112 degrees and then over top of an oven and stove.
It'd be so much fun.
In a small box.
Did I mention I also love falafel? Okay. You're
good. You're in. Right. Way to go.
You win, Austin. How long have you lived in Austin?
So I moved here in the summer of 2000. So I'm coming up on 18 years.
Wow, awesome.
Yeah. It was a very hot dry year. Very, it was very similar to if y'all remember 2010 when Bastrop caught on fire and the drought and everything. It was very similar to that. It was we moved in July, so we just like right into the heart of it, and it was just like, what are we doing?
Wow, had you ever even been to Texas?
I had, well, and so what was weird is I moved from Las Cruces, New Mexico. So it's desert. Mm-hmm. It's hot, but it's like, it's very different from here. It's that desert dry heat kind of thing where it's literally 10 degrees cooler mm-hmm. if there's shade, you know, because the desert. That's not the case here. It's humid enough that it's like, it's everywhere, you know?
Yeah.
And also in the desert too, like every day, even in summertime, at nighttime, there's no atmospheric cover, and so it cools off a lot. It's like down in the 60s and 70s, even if earlier in the day it was 105. So it was the constant heat that was like, holy, it just doesn't relent, dude.
You're like, it's midnight. Is it on?
Yeah, I knew it was like coming back at like 2 a.m. from a show, like, you know, to my car, and I like walk like 2 blocks, and I was like dripping with sweat. And it was like, you know, it was like, gee, this is miserable. But anyway, I'm used to it. It doesn't bother me. It's, temperature doesn't bother me. But it was memorable because it was very hot that summer, even hotter than normal for Austin.
I think it was 114. That was my first summer up here as well in Austin.
Mm.
I just started college and it was...
In 2000.
Yeah. And I was like, ugh, no.
There was something like, you know, 60 some days in triple degree heat or something like that. It was like 2 straight months above 100 or something like that. It was, it was really hot. And I moved into this big, it was a house, but it was a rental property. And it was big, old, probably built in the late 30s, early 40s. Mm-hmm. And it only had window units. It didn't have central AC.
Right.
So those were just like cranking all the time. But they would still only put out so much coolness.
Yeah.
So there were like zones that you could stay in. You know, you had to kind of weave through. You wore a pattern through the house to stay cool.
Yep.
You'd avoid certain pockets because the AC units and the windows wouldn't quite reach. You know, the combination of the one over here and the one over here. There was like a dead zone that was like, you know.
No man's land. Yeah.
120 degrees no matter what was happening.
When I grew up in Boston and we only had window units, and to be honest,
sure, it's all you probably needed.
We had a window unit in my parents' room because they would tell us, well, we paid for it,
right.
So we get it. And we were like, but it's hot. And like, well, life is tough.
Get a job.
Get used to that. We're like, oh, okay. I see how that works out. But when years later, my dad got a little older and he was a little bit infirm. They had to, or they got central air just to contain the house.
Mm-hmm.
And now people are like, your house has central air? Mm. What are you, millionaires?
Right.
Like, it's ridiculous. It's like legit, like doubled how much the house is worth.
Wow.
Because no one in the entire neighborhood has central air.
Oh, wow.
Everyone's taxes went up thanks to that.
They were like, this is amazing. Look at this, you know.
Right.
It's so wild how it's kind of ubiquitous here.
Right.
Not so surprising, though, that as a first arrival rental, they would have swindled you into a property with just window units.
It was a weird. It was a weird thing, though. We visited my wife and I visited the spring break. I was in graduate school in New Mexico, and we visited in spring break, and we ran into somebody that we used to know. And this is pre-Facebook, pre-social media, so like you could fall out of contact with people and not really know where they wound up.
I remember it was a great time.
Yeah, and so we went to a play. I was like, one of the reasons we wanted to check out Austin, we knew the theater community was vibrant and cool, and there was a lot of stuff to do. So we were like, I was like, let's go see a play, and we went, and we ran into somebody that we had known from before. Selling the tickets to this play. I'm like, what the hell are you doing? You know, what are you doing here? So we got together after the show. We went back to her house, the house that we ended up moving into. And we're like, you know, just like hung out, caught up. We hadn't seen each other in 2 or 3 years. And we're like, and then later we decided we were going to move. We're like, we'll have to come to Austin sometime before we move in July and get an apartment. And about 6 weeks before, maybe 2 months before all that happened, we got a message from her saying, hey, my roommate that I live with here went crazy and bailed and is out, and I don't want to, I'm, she's like, I'm, it was such a bad experience. She's like, I don't want to live in a place with a roommate anymore. I can't afford to keep this place. Do you just want to take over the lease for us? And we said, yes. Yeah. But it was kind of sight unseen. Like, we hung out in the living room, but we didn't really, like, investigate the whole house right. and, like, ask yeah. about the air conditioning setup or whatever.
Or, like, how's the plumbing?
What's right. Yeah, how's the plumbing? What's going on?
Drainage, you know.
What's, wait, yeah. So, yeah, so we lucked into an apartment without having to do any apartment hunting at all. We yeah. just, I think, I can't remember, we took over the remainder of her lease and then just renewed it for another year after that. But, yeah, we didn't investigate very hard. It's like, hey, we got a place.
You were in grad school in New Mexico.
Yes.
Where did you go and what did you go for?
So I studied fiction writing at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces for 2 years. So I was there for 2 years. And then New Mexico is a real, I like New Mexico a lot. It's a great place. The food is great. It's beautiful. It's definitely, at least when we were there and in southern New Mexico, it's very much more of a place you retire to than you be a cool, creative young person. There's just not much to do.
And that's interesting.
Yeah, and there's not much to do and there's not much money for people, even if you wanted to try to create something, there's just not a lot of...
Extra spending money going on.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like, it's a, you know, like, we were in Las Cruces, which is a university town, which is, you know, compared to a lot of places, probably better off. But still, as a community, there's a lot, you know, there were a lot of migrant workers. There's a lot of, you know, people maybe not even with high school educations. Mm-hmm. You know, they're laborers. They're, you know, they work with their hands. They work with whatever. And, like, you know, they're not going to go see some artsy-fartsy, you know. I didn't know improv was a thing, but, like, mm-hmm. let's say had I wanted to stay, you know, do some sort of theater project or whatever, it's there just wasn't enough critical mass there to make something that kind of, you know, to happen. So,
yeah.
So when you got here, about how long did it take for you to start getting involved in improv and those things?
About 2 months. Like, 2 months? Yeah, I basically hit the ground running, partly because the person that we knew... was heavily involved in the theater community okay. here already. So, I mean, and not that she like was like introduced us to everybody, but it was like I already had a connection.
Right.
And I'm, you know, I'm pretty tenacious about just like inserting myself into situations. So I just would like go out to stuff and meet people and, you know, and eventually I started taking improv classes at the very end of 2000, like in October, November of 2000. And then I was like cast in at the Hideout Theater's house troupe, essentially.
Right.
It was a different setup than it is today, but they had like a house troupe. And I was cast in that group at the end of, in December of 2000.
That's great.
So I started doing improv shows full time, like all the time in like January 2001. So...
That's really great.
Yeah.
I was going to ask if it was the Hideout, so I appreciate you saying that.
Yeah, it was at the Hideout.
It would just be that at that point.
So, it was kind of twofold. There were like two theaters in town at the time. And so I had just missed out on, there was like a previous wave of improv in town that I missed out on in the late 90s. And that was a lot of it was centered at... the Velveeta Room. They had a house troupe called Monk's Night Out. And
oh, yeah.
and they, a lot of those guys put on this festival called the Big Stinkin' Improv Festival. And they were like, kind of like, we want to be like the South by Southwest of comedy. And it was like, it was big. Like they had industry people here from the get-go. Like they would have Comedy Central and, you know, all this kind of stuff. But this is a little, the late 90s. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, there's a lot of money kind of flying around and Absolutely. All that kind of stuff. This is before my time. So it had just basically, I got here and all of that was kind of crashing down. I wasn't aware of how that worked out. But the people who were Monk's Night Out and who were kind of responsible for Big Stinkin' Festival, a big contingent of them moved to Los Angeles about the time that I moved here. So they moved to LA. Like Pamela Ribbon is one of them, who's now like writing the Wreck-It Ralph 2 movie. You know, yeah. She wrote Moana for Pixar. Like, you know, so there's this like Austin pedigree out in Hollywood that came out of that scene. They opened this theater called Bad Dog Theater, which is on the corner of Riverside and Congress. It has subsequently been about 25 different things. It's a big, weird, warehousey space. It's super weird. It's kind of down by the where the Austin Statesman is, the Austin American Statesman. Big, weird space. And, like, the state... I wanted to check out some improv, and I had seen some stuff at Hideout. And I went, and I saw, actually, UCB performed. They came in, like, the fall of 2000. You know, the main four, like, mm-hmm. back when that show was... They were right. just getting off the air and everything. So, you know, Polar and everybody. And the stage was, like, very shallow and very long, wide. And it was just, like, this is a really weird... It just, like, the space was weird. And anyway... I was kind of like, I basically flipped a coin. Where am I going to go take classes? Am I going to go to the Hideout or Bad Dog? And I think just the environment of the Hideout was just ever so slightly better. And I went there, and I'm glad I did, because Bad Dog went belly up like within yeah. 6 months. Within like 6 months of me starting to do improv, I felt like it was just, they couldn't, it was the monthly rent there was so fucking high
yeah. Yeah.
that they couldn't keep it going. And like what would happen was, they, because the rent was so high, they eventually got to the point where they weren't allowing their own performers to play on the stage because they needed to bring in guest acts all the time to hopefully draw enough audience to sell enough liquor that they could keep it open. And it didn't work out that way. But
yeah, theater as a business, not really great.
Yeah. And a bar, you know, just like, and it was just like a, and then I think there's like, it's built, that spot is built over like a Indian burial ground or something.
Sure, sure.
It just turned over. It was like a gay sports bar for a while, and then it was like Steamboat Willie's.
It's not the one that
Le Bear?
Yeah, I was gonna say it's not the Le Bear building, is it?
I don't remember.
Because I know that building has been 90 things since I've.
Yeah, there's been one building that's right near a bunch of municipal buildings, and it's nothing.
Yeah.
And I was like, this is prime real estate, people. And people,
is it the one like right on Riverside next to that Sonic?
It's
that's it.
That's the place. Yeah. LeBear, maybe that's what it was. Yeah. It was like a gay sports bar for that. Was that what LeBear was?
LeBear was,
I thought
LeBear
was men dancing. Like,
oh, okay. So then, okay, so then it was a different thing. It's been, maybe it's had a couple of gay cultural spots.
I'm sure.
Other things, it was like called Steamboat Willie's for a while. It was the Bad Dog Comedy Theater. I mean, seriously, it's been like 85 things.
Wild. So yeah, it's just cursed.
It's cursed. It's a horrible. I something about it. I think the rent is super high. It's a bad location. Like,
I think there's weird a zoning too. Limbo is what I heard about it, because I remember thinking, because back in the day when I was with the New Movement and they were at Rosewood and Chacon, we were looking for other spaces, and I remember being like, guys, this space,
that space
is nothing.
Is amazing.
It's just right here, and it wouldn't it be great? And somebody looked into it and was all like, the zoning of this particular section is ridiculous. There's no way we'd surmount it. And we're like, okay, never mind.
Yeah, moving on. What, like, surmount it just like from a...
from just like a legal standpoint, because
I don't know, like the number of parking spaces you would need to run it as a theater or
like to get the license to run it in, you know, in the particular area that it was. I think it, like, people are really making, like, noticing things, you know, they're checking you for fire codes, they're checking you for,
I see, it was like,
you gotta pay this license and that license, they
and
want to
get just
the
like
bar,
really on top
just
of
like,
it,
no, it's too much.
Well, and I just think it must be, because of its location, the rent must be crazy high, but then at the same time, it's like...
No one's renting it.
Yeah. Either, so I don't, you know, landlords...
It's a tax write-off.
It's somebody's...
Somebody's tax write-off, for sure. I was like, guys, turn it into a Hilton or something, right? For the love
just,
of God.
Just blow it up and, you know, make
up.
It...
Yeah, just build up. Who cares? You know, it could be one condo per floor.
But so I think it was... I mean, anyway, it was good luck, I think, that I chose the Hideout rather than the Bad Dog, because I was able to, like, you know, keep doing stuff or whatever. So
yeah, and you were at the Hideout even during its transition into what it is now, or I mean, what is it's sort of newer now, but the various incarnations of it being run by the team that it is now. And
yeah, like, so I was around, so I was like very heavily involved in the improv community from like, well, it's kind of weird. So, like, 2001, 2002, I was, like, doing shows all the time. And I think that's, you know, pretty common when people first get into it. I didn't have kids yet. My son was born in 2003. So, I took a year off in 2003. But I promised, or like it just worked out this way, that the Out of Bounds Festival, which was founded by Jeremy, then Jeremy Lamb, now Jeremy Sweet Lamb, is his new mate, new married name. But Jeremy Lamb and the guys who were in this troupe called Well Hung Jury founded the Out of Bounds Festival in 02. And they were, he was here in 02, 03. And then that's when my son, you know, was a little baby, and I was like not doing as much stuff just because I had a little guy and I was helping my wife at home and all that jazz.
They take up a lot of time.
Pardon?
They take up a lot of
time. They take up a lot of time, yeah. And anyway, but then the jury disbanded because they were all moving elsewhere. Most of them moved to Chicago, and they were going to go do the Chicago IO route. Mm-hmm. And all that jazz at the end of 03, and he handed the festival over to my friend Mike DeLonzo, and Mike and I, and Mike kind of was like, he wanted co-producer, he wanted, we, so we ended up taking it over, as executive producers together. So, in 04, that was like my first year as producer of the Out of Bounds Festival. So, so Mike and I produced that I mean, there's a lot of movings in and out, but, I was there from 04 through 08 as a producer. But in the, so like improv in Austin, like when the jury broke up at the end of 2003, the improv in Austin almost died in like end of 2003, 2004. It was like not doing well. Like shows would not, the Hideout was the only place in town. Sean Hill was like an absentee owner, and he basically let Andy Crouch just kind of program it however he wanted to, willy-nilly. But, you know, there was no, like, you know, Andy didn't have a free hand either to do exactly everything he wanted to do in the space. So it was like basically just kind of this open venue that people could book and program shows kind of if they wanted to or how they wanted to do it. But shows would not make all the time. You'd go there like on a, you know, Friday at 8 or a Saturday show or whatever and be dead. There'd be like seven people in the audience or whatever like that. So it was like a, it was a dark time back then. So I wasn't doing, even though I was like, the Hideout was kind of the only game in town, I wasn't doing a ton of shows there per se, except for producing the festival and making the festival run.
At what point in this, this beginning path of your improv career, did you sort of get into doing acting here, like in a voice acting, film acting kind of way?
Early on, so I've always kind of had a hand in, or like a foot in different communities here in Austin. So there's the improv community, there's the theater community as well. So I got involved with Salvage Vanguard Theater very quickly as well. So like by the summer of 2001, I started doing shows with Salvage Vanguard Theater, which was the play that I saw when I came in 2000. It was SVT at the Hideout. It was weird. Like I said, it was like all of my future Austin was kind of contained in this one little moment when we came and visited town and in spring of 2000, because it was at the Hideout and it was a Salvage Vanguard Theater show. So I got to be pretty close with Dan Dietz and Jason Newlander, who were running Salvage Vanguard Theater at the time, started doing shows with them. And Dan was a playwright. He's now like writing for Westworld and Person of Interest. He's got some good TV credits and stuff like that. But Dan had a gig as the translator slash writer for this anime dub or anime house called ADV, which is based in Houston, but they had a satellite studio here in Austin at 501 Studios building in the early 2000s, and all of us, all the local theater people would get cast in all the roles for these anime dubbing things. So I started doing voice work for them, and Lowell Bartholomew and Robert Pearson who are still around in town, they were like the directors and the audio guys over there. So it was like, it had this like super duper like Austin theater community vibe. Like all the old school Austin theater people have like a ton of anime credits. Then like happens in a lot of these places. So they overextended, like, in the early 2000s. They tried to start their own, if I understand it right, they tried to start their own like Anime Network, and it was just a little bit too early for the whole anime thing. It was like they were trying to do this cable network thing, and they blew a bunch of money doing that, and the numbers weren't there, the audience weren't there, and they kind of they sold themselves for pieces essentially, and the Austin anime studio closed down probably in like 2003, something like that. But you know, and then I would like audition for short films and things like that, student films at through the UT stuff and whatever. And I had done some film acting before I came to Austin as well. So I had a little bit of on camera experience as well. So that's like turned into some stuff. Ended up getting a agent in like 2004, I think, 04, something like that. So.
Right on. Yeah. I would like to ask a question about a little further back. You had gone to grad school in New Mexico mm-hmm. for fiction writing.
Yeah.
Was this right after college, or was this like you had gone to college, done acting somewhere in perhaps another city in the world, and then you guys moved to New Mexico?
It was the latter scenario. So I went to undergrad at the University of Iowa, and did a lot of writing there. I was kind of, they didn't have like a creative writing undergrad degree then, but I might as well have been given the number of creative writing classes that I took, etc. But they also had this thing, they also had No Shame Theater, if you've heard of No Shame, which I produced here in Austin for a long time. No Shame was like something that was run out of the theater building, and I started doing stuff there. And it was like, basically it was like open mic for the performing arts. Super theatrically inclined, not like stand up focused, but very like people would just like write. You had like 5 minutes and tops, and you just like, you know, people could just do, would you just do crazy performance art, theater sketches, whatever. So I started doing that. And by the end of my time there, even though I was an English major, most of my friends were like people in the theater department or affiliated with the theater department. So I had like a bunch of theater friends. When I got, and had done a couple of regular plays in addition to my own home crafted sketch comedy weirdness. After undergrad, I moved to Prague in the Czech Republic. I lived there for about 3 years.
Like on your own, like single guy in Prague?
Single guy in Prague. It's where I met my wife. She's American, but we met there.
Wild.
Yeah. And there was like, you know, there was a very strong, expat American and other expat community there. And then, so like it was a very strong scene, and there was also this super bizarre, entree into the film world there, because there was so in 68, when the Soviets invaded Czechoslovakia, because they had had this sort of like, we want to do communism, but not the Soviet way. And the Russians didn't like that at all. So they invaded in 68. Mm-hmm. And a bunch of Czechs were like, we're out of here. So they fled the country in 68. And a lot of them went to Canada. So I knew a bunch of Czech-Canadian guys who had like, then after the wall came down in 89, they'd come back and they were like, you know, getting back in touch with their roots. You know, like their parents were emigres or whatever. And they had grown up, you know, they were like two when the Soviets invaded or whatever, and they came back. But there was this crazy Czech-Canadian dude. He must have come over to Canada when he was like in his teens or 20s, because he was like in his 50s now, in the late 90s. And he had this crazy straight-to-video movie production house called North American Pictures that was like, they made action movies. I can't remember his first name. His last name was Shamandel. But... Lukash, I think. Lukash Shamandel. And they were like, I think they were based out of Vancouver, but they had like, they did all the production work in
Czechoslovakia.
In Czechoslovakia. Czech Republic, right? So they bought this like weird potato warehouse about an hour south of Prague, and converted it into a movie studio. And they would make these terrible action movies that were never intended to be theatrically released. They were released direct to video, like in Southeast Asia was like their market. I don't get it. It was like super weird.
Wherever you can. Yeah.
Yeah. So I was in a bunch, like, essentially my first film role, in any sort of meaningful professional film set way, was in a movie called Crackerjack 2 Hostage Train, with Judge Reinhardt as action hero Jack Wilde.
What?
Why aren't we watching that right now?
The plot of the movie is these like German terrorists. This is like a train filled with all the world's millionaires are going on a train ride, sure, because of course. But the German dudes have like mapped this all out so that when they enter this tunnel through this mountain, they blow up both ends, and now the train is stuck in the middle of this mountain, and they will extort the Swiss bank account codes from all of these millionaires, yeah, who just happen to be on the train. I mean, it's this ridiculous stuff.
Seems like a solid plan.
Were you a millionaire or you a terrorist?
I was a terrorist. Yeah, I did a handful of movies with those guys. There's this movie called Sleeping Dogs, which was this like future cryogenically frozen prisoners on a prison ship, but they get unfrozen and woken up with C. Thomas Howell as intergalactic criminal Sanchez Boone.
I feel like I've had to at least seen these on like UPN when I was like,
so you're like the kind of like somebody I worked with once was so like tracked down a VHS tape of it. I mean, this is like in the VHS era. Yeah, this is before DVDs, you know. So they were like, I don't know how they made money on this stuff. I mean, I really don't. Like, they were just like direct to video. They were never going to get a theatrical distribution. No print of it was ever made. So I did a handful of movies with that, but that was all through like, there was just this like English language acting community that went, so we were doing gigs on that. And then a lot of other, at the time, I don't know if it happens as much now, but like in the late 90s, there were a lot of films made in Prague because they had a long history of it. They had a really excellent, they had a very excellent tradition of filmmaking and a very great film academy there called FAMU, which is, you know, the Film Academy of Prague or whatever. And a lot of really great directors and whatever came. So they had a super experienced, knowledgeable, very professional crews there. You could get really excellent crews. It was really cheap, and like Prague was like, it's super beautiful and it can double for lots of European places wherever it might be, you know. It's like, oh, it's set in Vienna, well, you could film it in Prague. It's in Paris, you could film it in Prague, you can do all this stuff. So there's a lot of films that were made there. So I actually ended up getting a small gig on the 1998 remake of Les Miserables with Jeffrey Rush and Liam Neeson and Uma Thurman and Claire Danes. And so it's super weird. Like, you know, I was like in my mid-20s and I have some screen time with Jeffrey Rush and Liam Neeson and Claire Danes. I didn't get to meet Uma Thurman, but I did get to meet Claire Danes when she was like 17 or whatever. It was like right after my so-called life. Mm-hmm. And when we were doing Les Mis, it was like when we got done, Liam Neeson took off to go make The Phantom Menace.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow. It's weird to think about like the year.
When all this stuff was going on.
Wow, that's so wild.
Yeah.
It sounds extremely fun.
It was really great. It was a super good time. It was like, it was super fun.
It's nice, too, that some of the movies that were made in Prague were seen by people.
The North American Pictures thing is like ridiculous, but
do you ever write for them? Because even the two premises you told us, I was like, this is fascinating.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. Super fascinating stuff.
So somebody's sitting there in front of a typewriter.
So a few people from that scene have gone on to do some stuff. My friend, like, did you ever watch what are all those Stargate shows?
Yeah.
So there's like Stargate Atlantis Stargate, blah blah blah. So my friend David Nickel went on to, he was like the Russian doctor on one of those shows, Dr. Zarkov or Zardov or something like that. I don't know. Anyway, he's like one of those Czech Canadian dudes that I knew, like, you know, spoke both languages completely fluently and, you know, super cool guy. And he's had some success in the entertainment industry. Yeah.
Do you think that, I mean, I'm sure there's people in Prague to this day still making crazy action
there
films.
Could be. I need to, that, now that we talk about this, I need to go, like, check into North, see what's up with North American Pictures.
Yeah. They could be doing great in Canada. We
well,
just
they're
idea.
On IMDb, so I can maybe just, like, follow the rabbit hole.
Right.
Of, like, figure you know, figure out, like, the producer, like, what else they went on to do, and the director, and stuff like that.
I want to hear in a couple of months you've gone over to some South Asian country and like your pictures everywhere.
Everywhere, like, yeah, yeah, oh, yeah, wow. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Turns
never
out
know.
You're famous. You had no idea.
Yeah,
you
sign
that model release form. Yeah. They do whatever they want with your picture. Yeah. Then.
Speaking of which, have you done that kind of work? I mean, so you've gotten a lot of education in writing,
mm-hmm.
and then I'm sure, much to the chagrin of your theater major friends, gone and worked and done.
I've
really
done some
well
done
in
okay
film
and
acting.
Been done
you're
like
a drama degree.
Yeah, exactly. I have an English degree, not a drama degree, and I have like I have a decent, like, you know, I've got like a decent IMDb page
decent.
And a bunch
of
credits.
It took me forever to scroll. I've like,
oh,
my
finger hurt, you jackass.
It's real long. He's being super modest right now.
Well,
yeah,
so there's two things. One is some of those are weirdly double listed. Like, so I think, like, if you look on, like, IMDb, I'm, like, in the 40s or something. But, like, some of the web series, it's, like, it's listed twice because it's, like, each individual season is broken out as if it's its own entity as opposed to, like, mothershipped
right.
back up into its, you know, red versus blue or
right,
Ruby.
Right.
Like, I'm listed in Ruby, but then also Ruby season one and season two, and it's just like, it's a little weird, but I'm not an IMDb pro person, so
right.
I can't control, I don't understand how things get entered.
I don't think you can
control. I don't get how things get entered.
My agent told me that it was not in my control. I was like, but what are you talking about? He's like, you could have an IMDb page to look yourself up. And I did, and I'm there. But
yeah.
I didn't make it.
Yeah, yeah,
and there's like
can.
An old photo, and it's like all sorts of
I
things.
Don't even,
so I don't
yeah,
know who
yeah,
updates
I
it. There's somebody
it's
who's
this
like
mysterious
just sits
Illuminati
there and,
controlling IMDb.
Definitely.
It could be
yeah,
the I in IMDb is
because
Illuminati.
I thought for sure maybe it was agents. You know, they were like, let me show my guys credits.
It's cryptic
because
you can pay to be a pro thing, and then you can add your own photos if you're a pro.
Yeah, but that's all you can do with pro is you can add your own photos and you
edit
can
bio
contact
stuff or
other people. Mm. Other people who are pro. So, like, it's more of a sort of LinkedIn for...
LinkedIn for movie professionals?
So if you become pro, I could, like, go to somebody who's way out of my league and send them a message and say, hey, I'd like to work with you.
Which, and if they're high enough, it's their manager or their agent or something.
The
intern.
Or some assistant.
Tiffany,
right, who's
the
like,
agents.
I don't know what this is, delete.
Right, yeah, exactly. This is some nobody.
I don't know. I just erase everything from IMDb.
Right.
Yeah.
So where were you going with that? Where you were saying that? So I started writing, and then but I have a bunch of like film and other kinds of credits or whatever.
Oh, I was just thinking like as far as like the way you imagined your career, and then the way it has actually happened. You know, those two things are always different. But like you're all of the work that you've done on writing, have you been writing all the way through? And I just wondered if any of the stuff that you had written maybe had been something that you had made.
So I'll give you the long answer instead of trying to because it was going to take me as long to kind of encapsulate what
right.
the short answer was. So when I got out of grad, so I went to we left Prague, went to graduate school. I went to graduate school for creative writing, and it was the first time I'd ever been in an environment where I wasn't doing theatrical stuff. So when I was in Prague, I was like writing poetry and writing short stories and hanging out with a bunch of writers, but there was a theater community. I was always doing acting. And it was very similar to like when I was in college. I was an English major, I was writing, I was hanging out with theater people doing theater stuff. Hmm. I went to New Mexico State, there was no theater department. Hmm. There was no plays going on, basically. And there was no theatrical outlet. So I went and I wrote for a year and I realized, so I got this degree. This is not really what I want to do. I miss hanging out with people, doing stuff, creating work socially and collaboratively. Mm-hmm. And so I kind of got here and I just like didn't, I just gave, I, it was never like I sat down and was like, you know what, I'm going after acting and giving up writing. But it's just like, that's how things evolved. Like I just kind of kept, you know, improv style following my feet, and my feet kept going to performance and improv, and I kept doing more performance and improv stuff. So, you know, I was in some sketch groups, and I wrote some sketches, and we'd perform those and that kind of stuff. But I have not really done that much writing until maybe the last handful of years. Oh, and the other part of it is, professionally, most of my, like, day gigs are all centered around writing. So, because I have, you know, I have something of a pedigree that whatever, like, my first professional job here was working for the Texas Assessment Agency, because I had, like, some, you know, journalistic and writing skills, and that got me into that, and everything has kind of moved from that. So I've just been a copywriter or a web writer or some kind of writing capacity everywhere that I've gone, and so that's, like, my day, 9 to 5, and it just never felt that exciting to then keep sitting in front of a computer screen writing more stuff. After that, so it's I need to be around people who are going to make me laugh, and let's make some crazy stuff.
Right.
That is interesting to know, because I was going to ask. My next question was going to be like, how are you? Are you legitimately acting, and that's what's paying the bills? Or but you
no,
know,
I have I yeah gigs. I have no. You know, it's short. Sometimes short term, sometimes longer term. I mean, you know, I've been some places 4 or 5 years at a time, and other places, like, you know, 6 month contract or whatever. It's just kind of, you know, that's been the way my career has gone. On the LinkedIn professional side of the fence.
Writing, yeah.
So to get back to that, so recently I have started writing more. So I ended up writing a couple episodes for Red versus Blue that were produced two summers ago.
Great.
I'm working on a couple of screenplay kind of stuff right now. So a TV show pitch with a pilot episode that I'm working on, and a show bible and all that, and then a feature length thing, and then I've got a, you know, notes on other kinds of projects that develop down the line that are all, you know, written and my thing and whatever. Because then that's one of the things also is, like, not to you know, a lot of acting in this world is, like, in the film and voiceover world, you're still waiting around for people to decide whether or not you get to do the thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, you're not quite as in control of your own destiny. I mean, improv is great because you can go make your own show. That's awesome. But it also doesn't pay.
Right.
And then the paid acting gigs, you're waiting on permission from somebody else, basically, to say, yes, we like you for this role or not. And then, so the writing is just, like, another possible avenue to, like, be able to do stuff under my own control.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are you saying in the comedy world for your kind of feature and TV pilot?
The feature is very comedic. The pilot is so not funny at all. It's like a historical drama.
Okay. Yeah.
And it's a drama. There's, like, I mean, there might be funny things in it, but I really, it's pretty straight-laced, button-up history piece. Yeah.
Yeah, so. Because, like, dream for me, I do lots of comedy stuff, but then, like, I want to do a straight horror movie, you know?
Yeah, man.
Like, so it's one of those, just because this is the thing you do a lot of doesn't mean there's that other passion.
You can't do other things, yeah, right? Yeah. So I mean, that's like those. Look at Jordan Peele or whatever. Right. I mean, like, that's, like, totally, like, his deal. I mean, that's, you know, sketch comedy wizard to then, like, making this amazing horror movie, whatever.
Yeah,
he should be a hero to emulate for you, for sure.
Oh, I would love
improv,
to have that.
Yeah, then does a horror movie, wins an Oscar, take it.
Yeah. Bad TV, right? then came
there building. You go. There you go.
You know what, though? I recently heard, I was listening to somebody on a podcast talking about Mad TV, and they were like, yeah, I mean, it was a good experience, but it's not like it paid many bills.
Oh,
so
yeah.
don't be too, like, ugh, this so what a
I'd
great
kill to get that job. Right.
No.
I feel like I've heard some interviews with ex-Mad TV people too, and just talking about that it was, like, a weird environment.
Yeah.
It's super weird because just now you mentioned, like, improv doesn't pay. You're totally right. And then sketch comedy apparently also doesn't pay.
Right.
And I'm like, what? Where is this?
What am I doing with my life?
At which point? And I mean, I know stand-up doesn't pay until you get way up there.
Right.
Come on, guys. Comedians. Can we just do some sort of march with a minimum wage for laughs? Like, come on.
Right.
I don't know. It's just it's a wild scenario. May I ask about your writing? You did a lot of education in what seems to be, you said fiction writing and the creative writing. Yeah. So that, in my mind, is more like novels, short stories, poetry.
Yeah.
How did you learn, or did you take classes, or did you just get a book to figure out sort of screenplay and, pilot? The formats are so specific.
Right.
How did you teach yourself, or did someone teach you?
It's kind of been a grab bag. So I have actually taken a couple classes on here's how to specifically on TV show, because TV is its own beast, you know, because you're not just thinking about given episodes, but season arcs and like whole show, like what happens in season, you know, because you want to be able, if you pitch in a show, they're, you know, most places are not interested. They want to be able to say like, oh, we can do 3, 4, 5 seasons of material out of this.
Yeah.
They don't want a one and done because it's not, you know, then it's not worthy. And you, like, I think the returns get better and better the more seasons you make. Right.
Yeah.
As far as building audience locate, you know, you keep using the same locations and sets and this like becomes more cost effective. So, so just even thinking about like, okay, like, what does a season need? What does a long-term show arc need? And that kind of stuff. Not to say that I've in any way mastered that, but I have like learned a little bit about that. As far as the nuts and bolts of screenwriting, I mean, I've been around the industry enough that I know what, you know, I know what a screenplay looks like. Mm-hmm. I know what good stage directions are. I know what's not gonna, what you can't write down because it's not playable or whatever.
No way for the audience to know what you're
writing. Yeah, what are you thinking? You can't, like, you can't write novelistically in your stage directions in a film because nobody knows she ponders her childhood, blah, blah, blah. It's like you can't show that, right? You gotta make that manifest. You know, and then, you know, I've got the right software, baby, so I can, like... screenwriting software is awesome because it makes you so fast, dude. You know, you get your names plugged in there and then it's like just hit shift and boom, you're like onto the...
A little public service announcement. Final Draft's given anyone with a previous thing upgrade for $99 now. So if you had an educational software from 2003, that's me.
Oh, nice. You can upgrade to the latest version. I have an old version, I think, as well. So I use Scrivener, if you've ever used it before.
I've heard about it.
Yeah, it's pretty good. Because Scrivener is like a good, it's like a right, it's not just for screenwriting, but they have screenwriting templates loaded in. So it's a great, like, it's really like a writing, it's like management system. So it's got like, the heart of it is the composition, right? So you go in and you write, but it's also got like layers in it. You can like, here are my notes and here's my... this and that. And like with the screenplay, you can shuffle your scenes around very easily and stuff. And then you can output it to Final Draft if somebody needs to look at it in a Final Draft format or something like that.
Oh.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I recommend it highly to anybody who's looking to work on longer term, you know, bigger projects than like, I'm going to write a poem this afternoon.
Yeah. No, I use Celtics.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah.
It's interesting. I'm like, Scrivener, okay, cool.
Yeah, you should look
especially
into it.
Especially with
it's
the moving
cool.
the scenes around.
You can move stuff around super easily.
I need that right now. Right now, I have a like, fourth draft screenplay that I'm, like, either going to throw away or going to rearrange. Mm-hmm. But the rearrange work is, like, because cutting and pacing in Celtics is not really
it's
a
not easy
thing.
Yeah.
And you can't really, it would be great to be like, oh yeah, just move those
move
around.
I'm gonna import
it to Scrivener stat.
I finally got like an Adobe Creative Cloud thing and I was like, oh, they've got a story writing thing, so a screenplay thing, I'll start using that. A month later, they send out a notice, we're canceling the software forever. Get all your screenplays out of
here. Oh, for real?
It's going away in 5 months. Yeah.
Oh. What was that called? I didn't know that.
I think it was story.adobe.com.
Okay.
It was just a story.
Well, you know, some lawyer was like talking to Adobe people, we just purchased a screenplay company. You can't do it.
What are you doing?
Like,
yeah, it's probably for patents. That's what all companies do, right?
Yeah.
Buy it for the patents.
Yeah. Bunch of BS right there.
I mean, yeah.
But it's interesting to know. In my mind, I too am moving towards
in that direction. Right.
If only just to, because I'm here with the baby all the time.
Right.
And less in, have the ability to go do the collaborative things we were talking about.
Right.
So I'm like, all right, write it.
Right.
Get it out. And, you know, living in Austin with Austin Film Festival, once a year I can go pick brains for,
absolutely.
You know, 2 weeks. And then I'm like, cool.
Yeah.
Okay, back to the drawing board.
Right.
Talk to people, but it's always, whenever somebody mentions that they do it, I'm always like, tell me how you do it, because some part of my brain thinks that I'm missing information.
Right.
Make sure.
I think with screenwriting, even more than a lot of other things, I think it's good to get it in front of people who know that world. So I worked on a treatment for this feature, and I shared it with some people who are like mission or screenwriter folks or whatever, and get some feedback. And just like I feel like everybody I talk to, I glean some kind of cool piece of information about how to structure things, how to think about scenes and, all that kind of stuff for televisual medium.
Yeah, I have a hard time when I'm writing, because I feel like, for instance, with comedy, I've debunked comedy to myself now, so I have a very hard time watching comedy movies and sketches, because I just know what's going to happen next.
I got you.
I'm like, okay. They've done it twice now, waiting for the third one. Right. Here we go, and we've got it. Like, just little things where it's like, I become, instead of enjoying something, I become analytical.
That's funny.
And so I'm trying to learn screenplays bit by bit so that I don't ruin the magic.
Right. I'll tell you, it's really weird, though. Like, I think most people who would know me casually go, like, yeah, that guy's pretty funny. I mean, like, you can roll your eyes if you're listening to this, and you're like, man, seriously, that guy is not funny. Whatever you think, dude. Okay, fine. But, like, I am so not funny on the page. I don't know how to write. I don't know how to write funny. My natural voice on the page does not come out comedically. I don't gravitate towards it. I don't know what it is, but, like, you know. And also, I do narrative improv. So here's the other thing that's weird. I do narrative improv. I know stories. I know how to make a story compelling. I know how to, like, create stories on the fly. I'm really good at that in an improv situation. I sit down at the page, I'm like, I don't know what a story is. It's just a bunch of people talking. And I'm like, there's no, what's the fucking story here? Like, it's really weird. I felt that a little bit in grad school, too, where I was, like, writing stuff. And I was like, and it wasn't satisfying to me. And then I started taking improv classes. I'm like, oh, that's what a story is. You know, and I felt like I really got a lot out of it. But then that hasn't translated back. Like, now that I'm writing more, I'm like, dude, this is just a string of scenes, like, you know, and an exposition. There's no, like, compelling story here. I don't know what it is, but I can't seem to get out of my own way on the page. So,
have you considered using any of the narrative improv stories that you've established in a show and turning it into a screenplay or something?
I think, like, we were talking, I think before, maybe even before we started recording, like, it's hard, like, in the moment of doing an improv show, it's like, it's hard to go back and then recreate it.
Sure.
So I think, like, I would need videotape of all of those things you know what I mean? I'm not even saying, like, writing it out scene by scene, but I think if, like, a week after doing a narrative show and you were like, quick, give me the elevator pitch of that show, or, like, give me, like, the three beats, give me the three acts of this as a feature, and beat it out for me, I'd be like, dude, there's like a super villain in the lair, or maybe.
So there were
three
of us standing there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it would just be all exposition. But I think, like, with, you know, yeah, some part of me is like, it's ridiculous in this town, especially where there are so many people who do narrative improv, that we're not then mining that as a source for material for more lucrative endeavors.
Sure.
You know, we're giving away, we're just tossing off first draft treatments every week, and they just don't go anywhere. You know what I mean?
You should start selling narrative improv shows to writers. I mean, like, free material.
Yeah. Right. Come, you need a thing. Right. Like, I think there's a lot of writers who would balk at that, of like, I don't need,
right,
I got ideas. You know, I don't need your ideas, but...
Isn't that funny, though? I mean, but you're right, but in my mind, I'm like, never say no to any sort of influence, any sort of creativity that you
right.
can soak up.
Right.
That's just me.
All of the screenplays that win awards that are based on a book, though, you know, it's like,
Yeah, do you have ideas? No, no, yeah, 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 right, yeah. Exactly.
It's like, at this point, they just reboot something. You'd be like, guys, so I have this idea. It's called The Terminator. What do you guys think?
Yeah. We can probably get 4 or 5 movies out of it.
You're like, all right, sweet, let's just do a new reboot.
What I found weird about myself, I won't even try to do either a short film that's serious or a feature. I won't even pin to paper unless I know like the act structure already.
Mm-hmm, right.
But with sketch, I will just start writing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's why I took improv, was I was like, maybe this will help the juices flowing. And then by the time I get to, you know, the second beat or whatever, I'm like, oh, well, this thing that happened already, I can bring it back around now. And I didn't have to plan it out. But with a feature, there's no way I could even.
Well, you know, if you're writing a comedy feature, you're just writing a series of sketches, right?
No, but I don't write comedy features.
I mean, that's all
I've only done one of those, so.
No, what I'm saying is, like, you know how to write sketches.
If
you know how to write sketches, you just keep writing. Every single scene should just be a mini sketch. Like, that's just how. Yeah. I mean, you watch certain things like, what was it? The Workaholics guys just came out with a Netflix movie. Mm-hmm. And I was like, yeah, all right. I get it.
Yeah.
Right. I see what it's going to be.
Right. Yeah.
I look forward to that. I was like, you know, my husband sent me a message.
I just watched it today.
Oh, great.
Oh, yeah, what's it called?
And it's
definitely not called Die Hard with Dick.
No,
but like, what is it called?
Welcome to the Party or something like that? Or something real ridiculous like that, yeah.
Yeah, it's... it's one of those very... But their jokes are all just simple.
Yeah.
Like, I've tripped over and slammed my face on the ground. I'm going to punch a guy in the gut. Like, all right, these are hilarious. Yeah. Okay. And these guys will continue to do this. Oh, did he just cut his own hair off somehow with a knife? Okay, great. It's like, whatever. But it's just a series of, for them, there's an overarching story, but like, it's just sketch after sketch after sketch.
I've been interested in all of the people that are doing Netflix comedy shows and whatnot. It's kind of like this, they keep pulling the same actors from all these different shows, and so Netflix right now is a crazy system to me, because like it feels like it's its own studio of, I don't know, even a smaller community that are just like helping each other out. I know it's not, I know it's this giant thing, but like with all of the crazy actors that are just doing like one-liners in, you know, in a feature comedy thing, and it's just like, oh, okay, are you guys all just like best buds now hanging around somewhere at Netflix? Like,
well, yeah.
Yeah, I mean that's what it...
Well, that's also how anything gets done, that best buds are like, hey, guys, I get this friend who's got a mill. Do you guys, would you be interested in, say, making a movie? And they're like, high fives.
Well, like, I never had the... Like, it's a different feeling to me now than like with Universal or Fox or whatever. Like, I never thought about... Like, they're all passing... You know, it felt like all the projects are real disconnected. But now with Netflix, it feels like they're pulling all these creative people. They use a
similar stable of...
Yeah, and they're putting them closer together.
Interesting.
That, I don't know.
Well, I think that...
I don't know if it's true.
I don't actually know if it's true. But in my mind, there's like a handful of people that write comedy in Hollywood, and then that's who does it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they either do their own projects, like the Seth Rogen crowd, where they just do their own thing. They're not trying to get involved with something else. But people like the guys on the mail order comedy guys from Workaholics, they did Comedy Central is where their show first was, and now they're on Netflix. In my mind, I just imagine that somebody who worked for Comedy Central got a job at Netflix. I mean, legit.
Right.
Why wouldn't that just be, I mean, because between Funny or Die sort of fizzling in the web, people aren't watching comedy online as much. But somehow Netflix and other comedy sources are coming up. If I were a writer at a place where it was sort of a sinking ship, I would leap over to what's going well and then bring the people I like with me. But I mean, it's all that, like, you'll see the same people. What was it? I watched the new Netflix stand-ups, and I was like, oh, I'm just going to watch this so I can see who the guest players on every comedy show are forever.
Right, right.
Because
the first one
I watched, I was like, oh, this guy's in 7 movies I just watched. I didn't know who he was.
Right, right.
This random guy here, random... But I was like, no, now I know him. I don't know. I feel like that's kind of how it... I love that stuff, actually, when I see people in small roles. Like, it's like, the guy sells me toothpaste, and then a minute later, turns out he's the guy who's the murderer on Law & Order. I'm like, you're dead!
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's a bigger gig.
It's
a bigger gig. Yeah, it's a bigger paycheck, potentially. I don't know how much toothpaste pays, probably a lot. But yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting sort of path that the way those things connect. I don't know the crowd. I'd love to. I'm going to put my feelers out to see if I can't find out more about it. Wouldn't it be fun to talk to somebody? Like, even for just chat with somebody from, like, Netflix to be like, so I hear in every podcast I've ever heard about a movie that's been made under y'all, you do no checking. You go, hey, would you like some cash? Great, here you go. Make it, whatever. We don't care. We're putting it up. Like, and that's, like, fascinating versus other producers who are, like, standing there watching going, like, they might not like this. Right, what's going on?
Right.
So it's fascinating. As far as the work that you've done, have you worked on any big projects that have had any sort of, like, you know, big producers that have changed stuff? You've been in a movie where the plot line has changed or something like that?
Like, if I've been involved in stuff, it's so low level that, like, I don't... No, I've never... Well, okay, so I've had some weird industry run-ins or just, like, exposure to, like, the dynamics of the wider industry. But nothing, like... I've never been in a situation where I'm, like, battling a producer over, like, the line that's going to be in the thing. Or even been exposed to that. Like, that's all
or
settled.
It's, like, first time you're hired and you're a pilgrim. And then when they come back, you're like, just kidding, you're a robot.
Right.
And
no.
You're like, wait.
Nothing like that. So, like, I'm trying to think. You know, like, I was in, like, probably the biggest... property that I've been in. I was in an episode of Breaking Bad, but like it's TV. That's all like, so like by the time you're shooting, that's already all like on lockdown. Like it's very rare that it would be like, nope, we got to cut that scene and this guy, get him off the set. We got to get this guy. None of that kind of stuff comes up. They were still working, tweaking lines sometimes on the set, but it was like it didn't feel like, it felt like more like, hey, we're all collaborating. We want to make this scene as good as possible. Not like somebody's being a dick back in the home office and we don't want to do it. But so the probably like the biggest, like industry kind of stuff was like, so coming out of bounds, like anyway, it like, in like 06, 05 maybe, a couple guys, Mitch Baker and Dave Bewley, we had this troupe called the Edmund Bulldogs. It was basically those two, but then Jeremy Lamb and I were like the other two kind of featured players. So it was kind of a little bit like a four-man sketch troupe, but it was really Mitch and Dave. But we ended up kind of being part of that extended kind of group. Jeremy and I always called ourselves the George and Ringo of the quartet. You know, we were, you know, but so we made a pilot for MTV, like back in the early days of like when MTV had stuff, and we like made a pilot. It got some feedback and some notes from execs. We made a round two of the pilot. It was entered into the thing, and from what we know, we were second in the selection process behind Human Giant.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so then, you know, Aziz Ansari goes on, has this amazing, you know, has a great career or whatever, blah, blah, blah. And we were like right behind those guys. So it was like, ah, damn. And then, but in that process, they ended up owning the rights to the name of the troupe.
Oh, yeah.
So then we had to become, we ended up doing this other thing a couple of years later called Backpack Picnic. And we had a lot more freedom. It was in the early days of the web. And this was, again, it was like we were a little bit too early on a platform that didn't make it when streaming video was going, you know, was trying to get up off the ground. And we did like two seasons of sketch comedy as Backpack Picnic, which was the second name. But yeah, like MTV owned the rights and the name and the intellectual property, blah, blah, blah. That was like, I guess, part of the deal with the funding of the pilot was that they then owned. So we couldn't call ourselves Edmund Bulldog. It was weird, you know?
Yeah, that's so wild.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think about those.
So like that kind of stuff comes up all the time, you know?
Yeah.
And like, you know, and sometimes, you know, people will... You know, that's the thing with studios. They want to, like, if they're going to put money in it, they want to own it, too.
Sure.
So then, like, people have to, like, really weigh what's it to them to, like, sell outright something that maybe was their baby, you know, intellectual property versus you know, getting paid for it. So
what do you think about the idea of both of you guys? What do you think about the idea of writing a screenplay which gets purchased and never ever made?
It depends on how much they option it for.
Sure.
Is it all just money? I mean, is that...
Well, if that allows me to then get to another project, then it may be... Like, yeah, you know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hear that story, all or like that is that comes up a lot of people. Like, yeah, there are people who make a living in Hollywood who've never had anything produced. Yeah. They never go into production. They're always just in development and pre-pro level. I mean, development mostly, where it's like, yeah, we like this idea. We're going to option it and we'll do whatever. And we're going to pay you X amount to work on the script. And then, you know, goes through a couple rounds and then it dies. But then they're on to the next thing. And like, but so, you know, I don't live in LA. Yeah, there's apparently people who make their living, a decent enough living, just working on stuff that then never gets turned over into another thing. I think it would depend, like, how I would feel about it. I mean, obviously, I think I would love to see stuff produced with my name on it and see my vision executed out in the world and blah, blah, blah. But if it was done poorly or, like, exploitatively, that would be no fun.
Right.
And I think if you were working on developing scripts and were having a good time, and but nothing got produced, that would probably be okay. I think, like, it'd be really bad if nothing was produced and... And it was like you made enough money to make a living, but you despised the work because you knew that it was like not fulfilling. Yeah. Like that would be really, that'd be like having a, be like having a day job like I do or whatever. You know? Sure. Yeah, yeah. Yep. So I don't know. I think it just depends on the circumstances.
Like, I wonder just because like in the, since we're sort of talking and I feel like we're sort of all at the same level of like just starting to write it.
Right.
Like, had too much interest in anything that I've had to write, you know, that kind of stuff. But it's like, I think about these things like, okay, I'm going to have to be okay with it. I'm trying to become less precious with my words. I'm trying to write really well so they like it and purchase it. But then if they rewrite it and turn it into like, you know, a schlock piece, then I'm like, cool, totally fine.
Yeah.
I don't care.
I couldn't imagine, like one of those films gets 8 writers attached to it by the end of it, you know? Or you're watching the credits and it's just like, there's no way this movie's going to be good.
Well, not to mention the fact that when you look at credits, they don't actually explain what work was done in a movie at all. Like, when you're reading the names and their titles, it doesn't mean what they mean.
One of the, I met some of the writers from the movie SWAT. I don't know if you guys remember that. It was like, the guy was at Austin Film Festival, and I was in, you know, volunteering or whatever, driving them in, and was super excited because I watched the old 70s TV show. And I was like, this could be great, and this guy, I can't remember what he had worked on before, but I'd known his name, and he was like, yeah, I'm working on it with these some other people. I've already, you know, started it, and then right before it came out, I looked, and there's like 6 other people, and it was just like, oh no, like,
this that's is not going
to
be
the studio. Yeah, just decided we need to send it to somebody else and you know, touch it up some more and more. So I can't imagine being that first person who you created that script and it was your baby and you're like, this is great. And they option it. And then they're like, we're just going to run it into the ground with more and more ideas because, you know, whatever.
I don't know. I think I've had enough sketches that I've written, thought were great, and then watched people perform them not well, or they didn't memorize any lines. And then I'm like... Well, I guess I'm going to have to let that go. You know,
right.
And it's like I get 1 or 2 performances of it, and then maybe I could bring it up so somebody else can play it. But it's like, oh, okay. I guess that. But I mean, after a few years, you kind of just let that go. You know, like, yeah, it's fine.
Why do you keep looking at me when you're...
Have you butchered some of her sketches?
I 100% have.
No, you're a good memorizer. There's some people that don't even try. So, before we wrap up, I feel like there's a little chunk in here that I'd like to ask questions about. And what, I guess to get to the meat of it, after you started performing improv, flash forward and now you're teaching.
Right.
And is your primary improv home, is that with Merlin Works now?
So I don't really have a primary improv home right now. So for a long time, so flash forward, so this is why, like, when the Hideout was changing over, I was kind of already not part of the Hideout ecosystem, because I was doing stuff at Salvage Vanguard Theater.
Right.
as my own production company, Gnap, and Shane and I do shows together. So we had this kind of like co-branded thing where Merlin Works was doing the classes and Gnap was producing all the shows over at SVT. And that basically, that regime, that lineup basically lasted from 2008 to the very end of 2012. And then through some through some things, Gnap basically stopped doing regular show production at the end of 2012. We moved into 13, Merlin Works moved over to Zach Scott. So they've been over there for the past 5 years. And I taught there for a little bit, but it just like, I'm in a place, like it wasn't worth it for me, like, financially and time wise to devote my energy to teaching improv, with a family and I got other projects going on or whatever. I think, so I found like the best, I think the best improv teachers are broke single people. You know what I mean? They really care. They need the money. They're going to go do the extra whatever, you know, really commit to being great teachers and all that kind of stuff. I think your most devoted teachers are going to be broke single people.
Oh, that breaks my heart a little bit.
I don't know. I mean, that's just my to take a step back. And that doesn't mean that you aren't or can't be a right. good teacher.
Yeah.
But I think like as a resource pool that's going to be your best place to go fishing for good improv teachers.
Broke single people, we need you.
Right. So this is it. All yeah. Oh,
it's our primary audience. So broke single people. I feel like
broke single people, no kids. Mm-hmm. There it gets even more complicated.
It's a huge crowd. I'm telling you.
Yeah, it is a big crowd. It's that's like 95% of the comedy performers in the world. Anyway.
Yeah.
So I haven't really done. I haven't taught at Merlin Works in years and years. And Shane and I are still really good friends. We still have get up, still performs periodically. But so I mean, like. I find myself drawn to the shows at the Hideout the most of any other place in town, but not always. There's some shows there that I just don't have any interest in, you know, auditioning for or being in. So I have directed a couple. So after Gnap stopped producing shows at SVT, I have directed. I directed a show at the Hideout. Two shows, one show. I can't even remember. I directed one show at the Hideout. I've been in a couple of their main stage shows. I'm actually casting one right now. That's in the rehearsal process. So I would guess it's kind of maybe the Hideout, but it's like Hideout affiliate. Like they have a very strong core crew of their teachers, their tech crew, the people who they run whatever for them. And I'm not any of those people. But like I do shows over there. Yeah, that's probably. But it's not. It's not my home. I just kind of make a home where I can. So.
And you're still going out on auditions and hopefully gonna be in movies that we watch. On
yeah,
Netflix
I hope so. Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Right. I'm is doing it mostly most film auditions that you do, or commercial?
No, it's mostly audition and it's mostly commercial auditions. The problem, the thing is here is like I wish. We need to get over the hump industry-wise here in Austin. Like, nobody casts local. Local actors get cast for outside projects sometimes and very rarely.
Yeah.
And it's like, and if you do, it's like there's a handful of parts for, like, day player kind of roles.
Right.
And I wish that because there's a lot of talent here, I wish we looked if it's outside production, it's happening. But what chaps my ass is there are a lot of indie producers in town, indie filmmakers in town, who have that same mentality because they want to have a bankable product at the end of the day. They cast Hollywood people.
Yeah.
You know, they don't cast Austin. They do sometimes, but it's not the main thing. And you know, and I've been working with Rooster Teeth, and they're moving more and more that way too. And I think it's part of it. It's like a certain kind of bankability outside of the thing.
Yeah.
And I just there's something, you know, I wish that there was just a little bit more industry, like business presence of the industry here in town, so that like it would be a, you know, people don't feel like they have to go to LA to make it or whatever. And yeah. And like I said, I have kids here and I live here, and like, so I sort of do my best to make work where it can happen. But it's, you know, I'm not going to be the lead in a, you know, in the sun anytime soon. I think that's the only show shooting in town right now.
You'll be the new guy that ruins everything in the leftovers next season.
Yeah, yeah. Are they still making that? I think they're done. No, I don't know. Yeah.
That was the last big thing that I heard that was filming in town. There was that, and then
there's the Walking Dead spinoff show.
Right.
Yeah. Is doing some filming here.
Fear of the Walking Dead.
Fear of the Walking Dead, right.
Coming.
Yeah, they just made it. Just added a word, so they're like, it's different.
It's the same people. They're still playing the same.
Well, it's like it's the same zombie plague, but in a different part of the country or whatever.
Yeah, absolutely. We're in Texas, guys. It's totally different. Yeah. It's just weird now. Speaking of Walking Dead, though, have you ever gone to Atlanta? Have you done any stuff there? I mean, I hear that's booming.
So, you know, I have toyed with, like, trying to figure out how to get an agent in Atlanta because that's where my wife's family's from. I have my in-laws there. I could, like, go. But I think again, for Atlanta actors, it's the same deal as in Austin. It's like, then you're like, oh, am I going to fly to Atlanta to be, like, cop number two,
right?
I don't know.
I mean, because my uncle is an actor in LA, and he is in his 50s. Sorry, Uncle Joe. And a lot of his friends are, you know, getting to be 50s and 60s, and they're
character sort of actors, and they're in
so they're
they go to Georgia
to Atlanta to settle down because they're like, I no longer want to deal with LA.
Right.
I just want to work.
Right.
And so they went to Atlanta. Moved, got an agent, and are just working on television shows there.
Oh, see,
and
now
I was
that's
like,
cool.
Huh, interesting.
So that's interesting, but now it'd be interesting to know what, like, are you just, like, seriously, like, one-line characters in a bazillion, you know, show after show after show?
Yeah, you're just very busy, but you're still only the rando.
Right, and but that could be fine. It's like the guy who's like, I'm working on screenplays that never get developed.
Right.
It's like, hey, you just love being on film sets, and film sets are, I love being on set. And if you love that environment and you don't want to, you know, have a answer to a boss in the traditional sense, have an office job, and you can like work, you know, 7, 8, 9 days a month working on TV shows. Even it's like, man, like if that's what you want, man, that's like, I think that's like cool, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'm a principal. So I'm a principal on a TV show that Rooster Teeth is making. I feel like bad that I'm like, oh yeah, Rooster Teeth only going to cast like low whatever. It's like, no, what am I talking about? I talked my way onto a recurring role, like a very good role on this on Day 5, which is a web TV series. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if I'd want to go like roll down into being like, oh, cop number two, and I open the door and the you know whatever. Like I've got enough of a taste of like, oh, this is fun to get to do some fun, you know, actual acting and being a pivotal character.
I've been cop number two for Rooster Teeth before, so
yeah,
you know, it's rock on. I'm trying to think if there's, I feel like you've told us so much about your life and hilariously not in any linear fashion. We were like,
that's great. That's how it should be, right? I mean, like,
Tina piece for fun.
Yeah, exactly. To me, Maron is the gold standard and he goes all over the map.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I
love Mark Maron's interviews with people and just like, you know, hitting on all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know,
I'm going to run over to Vulcan Video after this and
see if they have Cracker Jack 2.
Yeah, Cracker Jack 2.
So the three North American Pictures films I was in, you can look on IMDb. I was in Cracker Jack 2, Hostage Train, Sleeping Dogs, and Act of War, which was these are all made in the late 90s.
I feel like I may have seen them. I used to work
so in Sleeping Dogs. And I'm going to say this, and then I got to go, actually. I got to take off.
Totally.
Sleeping Dogs. Sleeping Dogs had one of the most ridiculous scenes ever. So we're on this spaceship. It's like 2,400 years. It's like, you know, 400 years in the future or whatever. Spaceship going from between moons of Jupiter, transferring these like space criminals that are in cryogenic freeze, and then they have a plant on the ship who thaws them out, and they're gonna steal the ship, and I don't even remember what their goal was. Now they were free though, and and they take over the ship. I played the first mate on this ship. The captain of the ship was like was this Czech dude who was apparently like a very famous classical actor in Czech, you know, he was like a stage actor, and he did like, you know, Hamlet in Czech, and in, you know, like all of the good plays at the big National Theater in Prague, and like this is, and you know, and then, but it's a small smaller culture, so they also end up doing a lot of film work and whatever. Spaceship captain, first mate, we were dressed in like nautical sweaters and like a turtleneck sweater and like little like navy caps. It was so ridiculous. I'm like, we're like, why the fuck are we dressed in like Irish sailors
tradition
in, yeah, it's like,
so they're real, like, superstitious.
Oh my god, the first mate, you know, and I had this like white sweater, and I get shot with an Uzi this android babe, and like, so I took squibs and the blood blows up and everything. But like, yeah, that's a great one, because it's like, oh my god, why are we dressed in like naval sweaters and like weird little hats?
It's the hat in the closet from the last film. That was,
yeah, so it's like, we're gonna make it happen.
I like the idea that it's just like a sweater with like just like a wheel on it. Like,
yeah, yeah. I mean, it was like, I might as well have had like a wooden wheel to pilot the ship with, because that's how we were dressed.
And you just held it like in nowhere. Yeah. I don't know what I'm doing, but I'm doing this. Yeah. Oh, that's so funny. Well, thank you so much for sitting down.
Yeah, thank you. I hate to run.
Oh,
I'm doing HEB curbside pickup, and I gotta get there in my window to like pick up my groceries.
Oh, you're so funny. I was gonna be like, you're doing a commercial for HEB.
No, I'm driving to, well, I actually inadvertently did a commercial for HEB. I'll be invoicing the Butt family down in San Antonio for my check.
Absolutely, yeah, for sure. Well, thank you so much for chatting with us, absolutely, and have a wonderful evening.
Cool. Thank you. I'm going to go get some groceries.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast.